Well, good day to everybody listening to today's teleclass. My name is Martin Kiernan. I'm a nurse consultant in infection prevention in the UK, where it's a very sunny evening. It's my great pleasure to introduce today's speaker to you. Here's Dr. Mark Rupp. Mark is a professor and chief of the infectious diseases and director of the infection control and epidemiology at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. He originally started his career in chemical engineering and then went on to do his MD in Texas. After a residency in Virginia, he then did a fellowship in infectious diseases in the same area and is now currently, as I said, professor at Nebraska Medical Center. He's a past president of SHEA. If you haven't heard him speak, you'll almost certainly have read one of the many, many seminal papers that he's been involved in authoring. And today he's going to be speaking to us about what's new in intravascular devices. So welcome, Mark.
Martin, thanks so much for that introduction. And also I need to thank Paul Weber for giving me the opportunity to participate. I'm delighted to do so. And it's, I think, a terrific way to get the message out and to do some broad educational outreach. So I'm very pleased to be able to participate in this. Hopefully everybody has the slides pulled up on their computer. And so as Martin related, the first slide is just simply the title of what's new in intravascular devices. And in the spirit of full transparency on the second slide, I've listed absolutely everything that I can remember of any company that has given me money for anything in any form. So you've got the full set of disclosures there. My goal is to give as a fair-based presentation as I possibly can. If you do somehow detect some sort of industrial bias or taint to my presentation, I would really appreciate it if you would send me some sort of an indication of that, or drop Martin or Paul a comment on the website so that they can pass that on to me. Because again, that's certainly not my intent to try to promote any specific product. Now, the objectives for the presentation are shown on slide number 3. And very briefly, we're going to talk just a little bit about the clinical significance of catheter-associated bloodstream infection, or sometimes the terms are used fairly interchangeably of catheter-related bloodstream infections. And for the most part, I'll probably stick with the terminology of catheter-related. But a lot of people do use these terms fairly interchangeably. The catheter-associated or CLABSI is more of a surveillance definition, and the catheter-related bloodstream infection tends to be more clinically defined. On the second bullet point there, you'll note that we'll talk just, again, a bit about the pathogenesis of these infections. And the goal is to not dwell on either of those points very much, but to really stress more of how we prevent these infections. Very briefly, we'll talk about some practice measures that are known to prevent catheter-related bloodstream infections, and then we'll spend the vast majority of the time speaking about technologic innovations and specific devices and things that have been brought to market that appear to have some beneficial effect in preventing these very important infections. Now, if you'll go to the next slide, slide number 4, is titled Clinical Significance of CLABSI. This is some data from the United States that I think illustrates the clinical significance of these infections. And in a very recent publication from the Centers for Disease Control, it was estimated that there are about 80,000 central line-associated bloodstream infections in the United States in our intensive care units and dialysis units each year. And in the report from the National Healthcare Safety Network, in which there's over 3,000 hospitals, it was noted that the mean rate of central line-associated bloodstream infections ranges from about 0.6 all the way up to about 3.5 per 1,000 central venous catheter days. And that's quite a range, and it basically indicates that in some units where we have more standardized medical surgical type of patients, the rates are typically fairly low now in the U.S., and in some of our higher-risk populations, such as burn units, you may find rates that are still, you know, as high as 3, 4, or 5 per 1,000 days. You can also see on the final bullet point that these infections, when they do occur, are very clinically significant. It's an estimated mortality rate of about 12%, which I think actually may be a little bit of an overestimate. But nobody argues with the fact that when people develop these infections, that they cost a lot of money and a lot of resources, and they range anywhere from about $7,000 up to maybe as high as $30,000 U.S. dollars per infection, and that people spend a lot of time, extra time in the hospital when these occur. So typical estimates are that folks will stay in the hospital for a week or longer when they develop one of these infections. So again, some degree of mortality, but certainly a lot of excess economic cost and a lot of extra hospital stay. Now, in order to not be too U.S.-centric, on slide number five, I've put in some recent data from various European countries. And you'll note that in a large point prevalence study known as the EPIC-2 study, this was published back in 2009, in a very, very large single-day surveillance involving about 14,000 adult ICU patients, they found that over half of them had some type of infection, that about 15% had a bloodstream infection, and nearly 5% on any given day seemed to be involved with a catheter-associated bloodstream infection. Similar data from the German equivalent of the CDC's surveillance system known as the KISS, or K-I-S-S, in 2008, involving 26 ICUs, the mean infection rate was about 2.6 per 1,000 central venous catheters. So pretty much on target in many of these developed countries with the rate of infection of somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 to 2 to 3 per 1,000 days. And then again, the last bullet point from a number of countries in the European Union, with over almost 300 ICUs, median central catheter rate was about 1.5 per 1,000 central venous catheter days. So again, almost all the countries that have these types of surveillance systems are reporting infection rates somewhere in that range. So it is, again, a nationwide and worldwide problem that is quite clinically evident. In the next slide, number six, it shows just an encapsulation of what we know about the pathogenesis of these infections. And it suffices to say that for non-tunneled temporary central venous catheters, the skin serves as the major reservoir and route of infection for these catheter infections, and that the organisms remain resident in the hair follicles and the sebaceous glands, where they're very, very difficult to eradicate. Pretty much no matter what you disinfect the skin with, after a relatively short period of time, these organisms will rebound on the skin. And from there, they're able to track down the external surface of the catheter to cause an infection and gain access to the bloodstream. Now, the longer a catheter is in place, and certainly true for tunneled central venous catheters, the hub becomes the real site of action. And the longer the hub, the longer the catheter is in place, the more likely it is that somebody breaks down in their aseptic technique and contaminates the hub, and then the organisms are able to track down the internal surface, the luminal surface of the catheter, to gain access and cause infection. Now, rarely do catheters become hematogenously seated. We think that that's actually clinically a very rare occurrence. And thankfully, due to the various sorts of quality control practices that are in place, relatively infrequently do we infuse contaminated fluids into the catheters. Now, that does still occasionally occur with some breakdown in the manufacturing process, but thankfully this is a fairly rare occurrence. Now, on the right side of the slide, you see what is an electron micrograph of an experimentally infected catheter after about 24 hours of infection. And so what you can see there is that within a very short period of time, typically within just a day or two, the organisms are able to gain access to the catheter. They stick to various surface defects of the catheter. They then proliferate. And as you can see in this picture, they're starting to coat themselves in this amorphous material that we call biofilm. Now, when the infections get to this point, it's very difficult to eradicate the infections with medical management. And for the most part, we're talking about removing these catheters from patients in order to treat them effectively. And that's why it's so important to prevent these infections in the first place, because it's awfully tough to to treat patients with these infections when the catheters are in place. So moving on to slide number five, we'll turn the table a little bit and now start to talk about the prevention of these infections. And the first thing I want to touch on just briefly is practice interventions that are designed to prevent these infections. And on this next slide, number eight, I think is a study that many of the listeners are very familiar with, but this was a landmark study that indicated that some fairly simple practice interventions can radically decrease the risk of infection. And so this is a paper that details what's known as the Keystone Project. This was performed in over 100 ICUs in Michigan. And you can see on the left-hand side of the slide the interventions that were introduced that have come to be known as the catheter bundle. And essentially it's a series of interventions that are done, usually tied together with a checklist and some practices to try to ensure that these things are put into place. And by doing this, the investigators showed that the infection rate within these Michigan ICUs decreased, as you can see on the right-hand part of the slide, from about 7.5 per 1,000 days down to an average of about 1.5 per 1,000 days. This was a spectacular finding and a really remarkable decrease in the infection rate. And then again, you can see that these interventions are relatively simple, that you want to have a daily goal sheet within the ICU where people are focused on the catheter and determining whether it's needed and whether it can be removed. When you insert the catheter or manipulate it, you should be doing hand hygiene. You should use full sterile barrier precautions when a catheter is inserted. And what I mean by this is that when a catheter is inserted, the person who is inserting the catheter should be wearing sterile gloves, a long sleeve sterile gown, a cap, a mask, and a head-to-toe sterile covering for the patient. In addition to that, they should be using chlorhexidine as a preferential antiseptic. The chlorhexidine has a longer residual activity, and in a number of studies has been shown to be beneficial. There's some data to suggest that we should be avoiding the femoral site. I think this is particularly important in obese patients where they have difficulty disinfecting and keeping clean the inguinal and femoral area. And so those are the interventions that have been come to be known as the catheter bundle. And by doing that, again, these investigators showed that they could radically decrease the infection rate. Now, subsequent to this, the studies have been expanded, and it's been shown that this is a very sustainable type of operation. So again, in the same ICUs as well as a variety of venues where this has been put into place, it's now been shown that this is something that can be sustained over a period of years. And it's been shown to have real impact in terms of cost and mortality. So this has been a tremendous advancement in our field. Now, in this study and in the subsequent studies, I think that there continues to be a number of questions. It's not really known which components of the bundle are perhaps more important than others. Most studies don't really document what the compliance rate is with the catheter bundle. There's always been a question of what sort of technologic innovations have been introduced, sometimes in concert with the bundle approach. And then there's some nagging doubt as to whether the definitions are the same, how they're being applied, whether people are kind of gaming the system, and what kind of validation measures are in place to make sure that everybody's playing by the rules. But having expressed those doubts, again, it's been demonstrated, I think, in enough places, in enough different kinds of settings, that this really is a valuable practice and something that everybody should be striving to put into place within their institutions, both in the ICUs as well as the rest of the hospital, and even in our outpatient settings, these things are important. Okay, so I'm going to change gears again and now talk about what is available from a technologic standpoint. What kind of new products are coming out? What are the innovations with intravascular catheters that people can be considering to help prevent even more of these infections? And so moving to slide number 10, I've put a slide here that shows the major types of central venous catheters that are available on the market that people can purchase and use in their hospitals. I don't know that these are all available in all the different countries that the webinar is being played at, but these are the major types of catheters that are marketed in various types of countries. At the top of the slide is a catheter that is coated with chlorhexidine and silver sulfadiazine. On the left-hand side of the slide, you can see the minocycline rifampin-coated catheter made by a company called Cook. There's also a miconazole and rifampin-coated catheter. Multistar is the name of that product. There is what's known as a silver ionotrophatic catheter. This is coated by silver, platinum, and carbon. And then there are some benzalkonium-coated catheters, one with just benzalkonium, and then there's another one that's also bonded with heparin. And so those are sort of the major types of catheters that are available out there on the market. The vast share of the market and the lion's share of experience that we have with these catheters are the first two that I mentioned. So the chlorhexidine silver sulfadiazine-coated catheter and the minocycline rifampin-coated catheter. Now, on slide number 11 is a compilation of studies that were reviewed in a, I think, a nicely done meta-analysis published just a few years ago that documents the decreased rate of bloodstream infection associated with all the various studies that have been done on the silver sulfadiazine and chlorhexidine-coated catheter and also the minocycline rifampin-coated catheter. And what I think you can appreciate in this slide is on the top part of the slide is initially the first generation chlorhexidine silver sulfadiazine catheters. And if you look down the slide, you can see that they have a statistically significant decrease in bloodstream infections. The relative risk of infection is 0.68 that I've put in a little bit bolder type over on the right side so that you can see that these do decrease, we think, about a third of the infections, if you want to think about it relatively simplistically. On the second generation catheters, you can see in the next portion of that figure, about half of the infections were prevented in those studies, not quite reaching statistically significant difference in bloodstream infections. And then in the bottom portion of the figure, you can see the decreased rate of infection associated with the minocycline rifampin-coated catheters, where it's preventing about 70% of those infections, again, with a relative risk of 0.29. Now, a lot of folks have looked at these types of figures, and they've tried to draw conclusions about whether one of these catheters is superior to another one. And frankly, I think that that type of reasoning can be misleading. And so I've also put on this slide where I've just circled in sort of an aqua color the baseline rate of infection in the control catheters. And what you can see is that there's some fairly significant differences in those control populations. And so in the first generation studies, you'll see that about 4.2% of the control catheters were associated with bacteremia. In the second generation studies, 2.3% of those catheters were associated with bacteremia in the control arm. And then in the minocycline rifampin catheter studies, almost 6% of those catheters were associated, the control catheters were associated with bloodstream infection. Now, what I think this means is that there are some differences in the way these studies were done, and there's some differences in the baseline population. And so I think it's very, very difficult to extrapolate and compare one type of catheter with another when they're really not done in a head-to-head study. What I think the data indicates from what we know to date is that both of these types of catheters work, that the chlorhexidine silver sulfadiazine catheter, particularly the second-generation catheter, where it's coated on both the inside and the outside and has a higher percentage of chlorhexidine, and the minocycline rifampin-coated catheters, I think they both work, and they both work well. But I, unfortunately, can't extrapolate from this data and tell you which of the catheters is superior to another one. But again, I think both of them work and that they work fairly well. Now, going on to the next slide, slide number 12, I've put in some of the newer coatings and developments on catheters just so you can see what is either available or may become available or what's being worked on. And so the first of these that I wanted to talk a little bit about is the catheter that's coated with 5-fluorouracil. You can see that there is a nicely done study here, a multi-center randomized controlled trial where they've looked at the 5-fluorouracil catheter versus, I think, a pretty high hurdle, the first generation chlorhexidine sulfadiazine catheter. And they showed that there was some decrease in colonization, but not in a statistically significant fashion. And that when you looked at catheter-related bloodstream infection, the rate of infection was so low in both of those groups of patients that there was no statistically significant difference. And you can see the Kaplan-Meier survival curve as part of that figure. So again, I think that this is a potentially promising development, but it's really hard to document superiority when the rate of infection is as low as was documented in this study. The next slide, slide number 13, shows a novel coating with rifampin and miconazole. So it's got the, both an antibacterial coating as well as an antifungal or anti-yeast coating with the miconazole. You can see in a relatively small single-center study, non-blinded, non-randomized, so it does have some methodologic issues. But with the 241 catheters at the IJ site and 180 catheters at the femoral site, that these authors were able to document some decrease in catheter-related bloodstream infection compared to a non-coated control catheter. So for the IJ site, they actually had zero bloodstream infections compared to about five. And at the femoral site, as you'll note, the little bit higher baseline rate of infection that kind of goes along with the teaching of trying to avoid the femoral site when possible. And again, zero bloodstream infections in the coated catheter site for both the statistically significant differences. And you can see on the right-hand side of the figure, the Kaplan-Meier curve documenting that decrease in bloodstream infections. On the next slide, number 14, is a silver nanoparticle coated catheter. And unfortunately, in this study, it didn't seem to measure up. So this is a fairly recently published study, a prospective randomized controlled trial in five ICUs, a relatively small group, 338 patients participating. But what you'll notice is that there really wasn't very much of a signal for benefit of this type of catheter, that the colonization was the same, essentially, and the catheter-related bloodstream infection was actually almost identical in both arms of the study. So for this type of catheter, I don't think we're going to see much of a future for it. And then on the next slide, number 15, we've got some things that aren't to market, may or may not come to market, I don't know, but these are some coatings that various people have published on showing some potential with the chlorhexidine minocycline rifampin coating. So this is kind of taking the best of both worlds with the chlorhexidine as well as minocycline rifampin. That has looked very promising in some of the in vitro studies that have been done with that. And then there's another coating called Gendyne, which is a coating with gentian violet and chlorhexidine, which likewise is performing quite well in the in vitro studies that have been published to date. Both of these coatings seem to work better than either the minocycline rifampin by itself or the chlorhexidine silver sulfadiazine by itself. So, again, some potential improvements in these existing catheter coatings. Now, slide number 16, I think, is a very important consideration as anybody goes about trying to figure out what is going to be a cost-effective intervention in their own institutions. And in the older literature, for those of you who have looked into that or want to look into it, you'll see that in many of the cost-effectiveness studies where the rate of catheter-related bloodstream infection is relatively high, that cost-effectiveness has been demonstrated. And so for the coated catheters, the minocycline rifampin or the chlorhexidine silver sulfadiazine catheter, in these older studies, it was very nicely modeled that some significant cost savings could be realized. However, I think this is a little bit more of a sober look at the current situation, and that is when we put into place practice guidelines that decrease the risk of infection, what cost effectiveness do we then have with the additional technologic innovations? And so a quotation from this study said, the current evidence suggests that the cost effectiveness of using antimicrobial central venous catheters when in the ICU is highly uncertain. Policies to prevent catheter-related bloodstream infection amongst ICU patients should consider the cost-effectiveness of competing interventions. and decision makers would do well to consider the current gaps in knowledge and the complexity of producing good quality evidence in this area. So I don't know that, as they've alluded to in this statement, that we're going to see large enough studies in the modern era to clearly document the cost effectiveness, but it's something that we all have to keep in mind as we, have very precious healthcare associated resources to spend, and where are we going to get the most benefit for the most patients with the least amount of cost. Okay, slide number 17 shows some of the innovations that are available with catheter dressings. And so there are a number of dressings that have come to market. I think the most effective of these and the one that has the greatest amount of data associated with them are the chlorhexidine impregnated dressings. And you can see two of them that are available now in this slide. You have the chlorhexidine impregnated sponge dressing that's shown on the left. And then you have the chlorhexidine impregnated gel pad dressing that is shown on the right-hand side of the slide. Slide number 18 is a terrific study, and I think this is almost a must-read study for all of us who are in infection prevention. This is a study that was, first author was Dr. Tim Seat, and it showed the benefit of a chlorhexidine impregnated sponge dressing on prevention of catheter-related bloodstream infection done in intensive care units in which modern-day practices were in place, where we were using full sterile barrier precautions for the catheter insertion and that the baseline rate of infection was actually fairly low. And so what you can see at the top of the text is that the catheter-related bloodstream infection rate was 1.3 per 1,000 central venous catheter days in the control arm of the study, so in those patients who did not have the chlorhexidine impregnated dressing. And that dropped down to 0.4 in the randomized patients that received the chlorhexidine sponge dressing. And this was a highly statistically significant difference. In this study, they also tested the difference between changing dressings at 3 days versus 7 days and didn't really see much benefit to that. Again, it was done in an era of full sterile barrier precautions, and I think that's reflected in the low baseline rate of infection of 1.3 per 1,000 days. And about the only deficit that I've heard people express about this study is that for the skin disinfectant, povidone iodine was largely used rather than chlorhexidine. And so some folks have suggested that, if people had used chlorhexidine for the insertion of the catheter, maybe you wouldn't have seen the same significant difference. So I think that that's a relatively minor detraction from this study, but overall, again, showed a nice effect of introducing the chlorhexidine sponge dressing. Now, in a very similar study shown on slide number 19, same group of investigators largely, using essentially the same type of study design, showed almost identical results with the chlorhexidine gel pad dressing. So I think this is, again, terrific support that a chlorhexidine impregnated dressing in the era of low baseline rate of infections can make an impact. And so what you see in this slide is that the rate in the control population was 1.3 per 1,000 central venous catheter days, and this dropped to 0.5 per 1,000 central venous catheter days. Surprisingly, almost exactly what they saw in the previous sponge dressing study. So again, highly supportive that either of these dressings seem to work fairly well in an era where the baseline rate of infection is fairly low. And you can see the Kaplan-Meier curve there demonstrating this statistically significant difference, starting at about 5 or 6 days of catheter dwell time and then widening as time went on. As in the previous study, full sterile barrier precautions were used in this study, and then a large number of folks also had skin cleansing at the time of insertion with chlorhexidine alcohol. And so this kind of, I think, diffuses the detraction statements that I had in the previous study, that even when chlorhexidine is used for the initial catheter insertion, you still seem to see some benefit from the chlorhexidine impregnated dressing. And so I think that both of these dressings are available in various markets, and it would appear that they're effective. Now, in the next slide, slide number 20, this carries the chlorhexidine theme a little bit further. And so the question is, can we bathe patients with chlorhexidine on a routine basis and also get a decrease in bloodstream infections? So these are two studies that were done from Chicago. You can see the journals and the dates of their publication. And in the first study, you can see that they were able to decrease the rate of bloodstream infection from almost 17 down to 6. And in the second study, they decreased the rate of infection from about 7 down to 4. And so I think the major question in these a little bit older studies is that the rate of baseline infection was quite high. And would you see the same sort of benefit in ICU settings or other settings where the baseline rate of infection might be somewhat lower? And nicely, some of those studies are starting to come out now. I'm sure many of the listeners are aware of the study that came out in the New England Journal just a month or two ago. This was published by Mike Klimo and the group from the CDC Epicenters group. And they showed that bathing with chlorhexidine, again, in an ICU setting, done in more of the modern era, likewise was associated with a decreased rate of CLABSI. Specifically, they showed a decreased rate of infection from about 3 down to about 1.5 per 1,000 days, about a 50% decrease. Their study sites included, I believe, a bone marrow transplant unit, so it wasn't all in just the ICUs, and that may explain partially why the rate was maybe a little bit higher than other places are seeing. But again, a very nice, statistically significant decrease in bloodstream infections from about 3 to 1.5. So I think, again, the data is stacking up and corroborating that bathing patients with chlorhexidine can prevent a catheter-associated bloodstream infection. There's also some added benefit potentially from this, that in many of these studies they've seen a decrease in rates of VRE, methicillin-resistant staph aureus acquisition. We had a study here where we saw some decrease in Clostridium difficile. So there may be some additional benefits from bathing patients in chlorhexidine as well as decreasing catheter-associated bloodstream infections. And then also very recently published, but not shown on this slide, was a study by Aaron Millstone and his group of investigators where they showed some of these same benefits in pediatric age patients. So I think that this theme of chlorhexidine benefit is expanding. Now in the next slide, number 21, brings up the point of what role does the hub play in catheter-associated bloodstream infections. And so this is a slide looking at a ultraviolet tagged marking solution when it's applied to a catheter hub, and then it's scrubbed for 5, 10, and 15 seconds. And it kind of is food for thought, I think, that, you know, when the hub becomes contaminated from people touching it or having it rub on the patient's skin, you know, how can we best clean those hubs and what role do the hubs play in infection? Now, on the next slide, slide number 22, I think very nicely illustrates that not all of these connector hubs are created the same. And in the United States, these were all introduced in an effort to try to prevent needle stick injuries in healthcare workers. Some of this concern has penetrated into other areas of the world, and in various other places, they continue to use stopcocks largely to put on the ends of catheters. In various other countries, including the United States, almost entirely needleless connectors, as you can see on this slide, are used. Now, as you can, I think, readily appreciate on this slide, that there's just vast differences in the manufacture and design of these hubs. And you can appreciate that some of these hubs look like they're fairly uniform. They would be relatively easy to clean and disinfect. And then there's others that have little nooks and crannies and crevices that I think if they became contaminated would be extremely difficult for a healthcare provider to easily disinfect. And this may explain some of the differences that we see in infection rates between these various types of connector hubs. Now, in slide number 23, you can see some of the evidence that that does associate different catheter connector hubs with different rates of infection. And so on the left-hand side of the slide are various studies that have documented that one of these hubs are brought into use, that the bloodstream infection rate can markedly increase. And then people are really working hard on this, trying to figure out what are the differences between these hubs and which of them may be more prone to infection. And you can see a little bit of that data that was presented in abstract form at the recent ID week that was in San Diego last fall, showing that there does appear to be some differences between certain types of hubs and the rate at which they get contaminated and how easily organisms are able to migrate across the hubs and get into the fluid stream. And I'm not going to relate on this conference call or this webinar, you know, which of these hubs is superior to one another. I really don't think that we know that. There are so many variables involved with regard to, again, what I've already showed with the diaphragm and the linking with the plastic housing. The fluid pathway, the dead space, whether the flow is laminar or whether it's a vortex flow, whether they're positive, negative, or neutral displacement valves. There's so many variables in these different catheter connector valves that I don't think we have a good grasp on what are the features that potentially predispose some valves towards infection and other valves that aren't. I think one of the most important features, as I already have mentioned, is the ease with which a healthcare provider is able to disinfect that diaphragm. And that's one of the things that we certainly stress in my institution when we look at you know, potentially bringing in a different kind of device, is how easily can people clean these things and hopefully prevent contamination and then infection. Now, on the next slide, number 24, because of this concern with contamination of hubs, people have started to develop catheter connector valves and hubs that are now coated with anti-infectives, largely silver. And I'm aware of at least two of these that are currently on the market. Now, in the next slide, number 25, is a little bit of the in vitro data for one of these silver-coated hubs. This was published by Dennis Mackey a few years ago. With in vitro studies, as you can see in bullet point number one, the silver-coated connector valve had a very marked bacteria static or bactericidal effect on a number of different bacterial species, where it was able to decrease anywhere from about 5 to 6 log reduction, and also had a nice effect against Candida albicans. Now, in simulated clinical use, in which the hubs were spiked with Enterobacter cloacae, Dr. Mackey also showed that over about a 3-day period of simulated clinical use, that the silver-coated connector valves appeared to have a beneficial effect in those valves becoming colonized, contaminated, and then being able to have the bugs in the downstream fluid field. And you can see that part of the study on the figure on this slide. Now, in addition, at the end of the 3 days of use, they did a biofilm assay, and you can see the results of that on the far right-hand side of the figure. And again, the silver-coated connector valve seemed to be associated with a lot less biofilm formation than the control non-coated connector valve. The next slide, number 26, is a little bit of clinical data with a silver-coated needleless connector. This is a small study, 25 patients in a hematologic malignancy care unit. They used silver-coated connectors, and then after 4 days of use, they took the connectors and evaluated them. You can see underlined in red on the material at the bottom of the slide that the rate of colonization of the external surface of the connector valve really didn't vary between the coated connector valves and the uncoated connector valves, and the p-level was a 0.49, so clearly not a statistically significant difference. However, when they evaluated the organisms that were present within the internal flow pathway of the connector valves, they did see a difference in that about half of the non-coated valves, they could recover organisms from the internal surface of the connector valves. Only about a quarter of the silver-coated connector valves were they able to recover organisms. And this was a statistically significant difference. And so, again, there's some preliminary data that these silver-coated valves may be of benefit. The next slide, number 27, shows a little bit of the clinical data associated with the silver-coated valve. This is an abstract that was presented by the group out of Emory, and this was a crossover study, as you can see, that they had two hospitals that were involved with this study. In the initial part of the study, they used the valve in Hospital A, and then after a period of time, I believe it was a year, they withdrew the silver-coated connector valve from Hospital A, and they started using it at Hospital B. And you can see that there looks like there may have been a bit of difference in the rate of infection that was described as infection per 1,000 patient days. And so I would emphasize that this is expressed as patient days rather than catheter days. They saw the rate of infection was 0.54 in the silver-coated group, and it was 0.73 in the control group. That was a statistically significant difference, but you can see, again, that there was relatively a small change, and I think that we've got a little bit more work yet to do in evaluating this data and also taking a look at these silver-coated connectors to see if they work. Now, in the next slide, 28, this is a meta-analysis and systemic review that Dr. Mackey and colleagues performed, looking at the rate of catheter-related bloodstream infection when anti-infective lock solutions were present. So you can see that there's 7 or 8 studies that are listed there, and on the table, you can see the rate of catheter-related bloodstream infection for the control patients, as well as what they were using there. It's called the vanc heparin lock solution. So that's what the VHLS stands for, is vancomycin along with a heparin solution. And if you look down the table to the bottom of it where it says overall, you can see that the rate of bloodstream infection in the control population versus the vancomycin lock solution patients, there was a decrease of about half of the infection. So the relative risk was 0.49, which was a statistically significant difference. Now, I think that all of these studies are sort of a proof of concept, and what it shows is that we can take groups of high-risk patients, we can put a solution into the catheters that the bacteria find noxious, whether it's antibiotics or antiseptics or what have you, and that we can prevent some of these infections. Now, I think we still need to do a lot of work on this. We don't know what the perfect combination of antibiotics are or whether we should be perhaps using different kinds of antiseptics rather than antibiotics because of the concern with antibiotic resistance. And so you can see down at the bottom of the slide that a number of lock solutions have been studied. And again, we have a fair amount of work to do on this to figure out should we be using antibiotics versus alcohol versus, you know, different kinds of chelators such as EDTA or trisodium citrate or what have you. So again, a very promising area of investigation, and I think a lot yet to come. In the next slide, number 29, one of these innovative lock solutions has been studied a little bit more rigorously, and this is a study that, again, Dr. Mackey took the lead role on. This was a lock solution that was used in a very high-risk population, our hemodialysis patients, and it consisted of a solution of sodium citrate, methylene blue, and parabens. And if you're wondering what a paraben is, which I was wondering when I saw this study, it's actually a preservative that people have used for a long time in the cosmetic industry. And so many of you are actually familiar with this. It's oftentimes in various kinds of shampoos and emollients and different kinds of lotions and things like that. So it's been around for a long time and used fairly extensively. But in any case, in this study, they had 25 hemodialysis centers. They were a randomized but an open-label study, and they showed quite nicely, as you can see in the Kaplan-Meier curve on the right-hand side of the slide, a decrease in the catheter-related bloodstream infection rate from 0.8 down to 0.2, a strikingly statistically significant difference. So I think this type of modality showing promise in a high-risk group of patients is something that really should be saluted, and we should be looking at using this type of approach perhaps more frequently in some of these types of patients. Another group of patients where I think that this would make great sense is in folks who are on chronic TPN. So these are people who have to have a line in. They're in for long periods of time and is a place where we're at high risk of infection. Now, in the next slide, number 30, shows a little meta-analysis on the effectiveness of using alcohol in lock solutions. And so this is another approach using an antiseptic for a solution that you put into the catheter. And you can see in a number of studies, four of them included in this meta-analysis, a very nice statistically significant decrease in the risk of catheter-related bloodstream infection. So again, this is a type of lock solution that I'm fairly bullish on and I think should be considered more frequently. Some of the concerns that people have with alcohol is that it can soften certain types of plastic. And so you have to be aware of what type of catheter material is being used and making sure that you use a type of material that the plastic won't be affected by the alcohol. Also, using alcohol in our youngest patients is typically frowned upon, so using alcohol in our neonates and some of our pediatric intensive care unit patients, again, the alcohol could have toxic effects. Now, in the next slide, number 31 is a little bit about some of the antiseptic caps that are now coming out. So these are caps that typically have a little sponge in them that is soaked in alcohol. On the next slide, number 32, you can see an abstract that was presented recently showing really not very much of an effect with one of the types of alcohol impregnated sponge caps. This was conducted at the Barnes Jewish Hospital in St. Louis. And you can see that the intervention ward went from 5.3 to 3.7 per 1,000 days, not a statistically significant difference. And likewise, the control ward, which is shown by the dotted line on that figure that's included on this slide, had almost no change at all, 5.6 to 5.4. So again, not a real strong signal of benefit, but something that intuitively makes sense, and I think that we should look at a little bit more closely. Now, in the next slide, number 33, is a study that does show some beneficial effect of these alcohol-soaked caps. And this was done out of the group out of Chicago. They showed in, I think there were four study sites that were involved in this study, that the catheter-related bloodstream infection rate decreased from 1.4 down to about 0.7 with the use of these caps. There are some methodologic issues with this study in that they didn't have concurrent control groups, but they did have a relatively rigorous study design in which they introduced it, as you can see, in the baseline period, where then it went to the intervention, and then they took it out of use in the third column that you see on the slide, and their rate of infection went back up to near baseline. So this is, a quasi-experimental study design, but suggestive that the caps had a real effect here. Now, on the line on the graph is the catheter-associated UTI rate, and they use this as kind of an internal control group, suggesting that they wouldn't really see much difference in that, but it might reflect differences in other infection control practices. So, again, I think that, there's increasing amounts of data that's starting to come out with some of these devices. This is just an example of that and something that we should keep our eye on. You can see also that they did a kind of an interesting cost analysis with the device and documented that if they use this device in all of their patients within their institutions, that it would cost them about $2 per patient per day, and that they estimated that they would decrease 21 infections, save 4 lives, and increase the availability of beds in their hospital by decreasing the length of stay by almost 60 days. Now, in the next slide, number 34, I'll bring up a topic that may not be very popular, and that is something, though, that I think we should talk about, and the whole idea of, which of these innovative products should we be introducing, and where do we get to a point of diminishing return where maybe it would be better to invest our resources elsewhere. So maybe trying to prevent infections due to Clostridium difficile, or maybe even something completely different in our hospitals, fall prevention or preventing pressure ulcers or something like that. Rather than investing more and more money into getting to a point of closer to zero, it may be better for our patient population to actually, invest some of these resources elsewhere. Now, I know that's not a popular viewpoint, but I do think it's something that's reality. And, you know, I think all of us should be putting into place the practice measures that I talked about earlier, where we can get a fair amount of decrease of bloodstream infections. And then we need to weigh the added benefit of increasingly expensive products and innovations. Now, again, I've presented the data to you here showing that a lot of these devices have tremendous promise and look like they work. And I think it's almost an individual hospital by hospital type of analysis that's going to indicate whether a particular device makes sense in your own institution or not. I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all approach for this type of consideration. Now, in the last slides, I'll put a little bit of a whimsical end on the presentation. I think many of you saw this study or this paper that's shown on slide number 35, in which in the EuroCup 2008, these investigators showed a clear association between the fouls that were given to various countries' soccer teams or football teams, as they call them throughout most of the rest of the world, and the rate of MRSA within those countries. And so I think you can see on this figure that there's a pretty strong correlation, statistically significant, with a p-value of 0.038 between the footballers and the rate of MRSA. So I thought I would carry this a little bit further and actually look at a little bit more recent data. And on the next slide, you can see that I've tapped into the European CDC database looking at the rate of MRSA prevalence throughout the countries that report. And you can see this map that I think most of you are familiar with higher rates of MRSA in some of the southern European countries and lower rates of MRSA in some of the Scandinavian countries. And then when I compared the rate of MRSA to the rate of foul play in the EuroCup 2012, which you can see on slide number 37, that the relationship with MRSA has kind of disappeared. So between the 2008 data that I showed earlier and then the current data, or at least the more recent data, the association with MRSA doesn't seem to be there anymore. But surprisingly, and maybe something that we should work on the right side of the slide, you can see that the rate of foul play, and the way I figured this is I just looked at the number of red cards and yellow cards that were given out per 100 minutes and the fouls that were called per 100 minutes of play versus the central line-associated bloodstream infection that are reported in a number of sources, and you can see there's actually a statistically significant difference there. Now, as we approach the Brazilian World Cup in the next year, if we can just get our footballers to play a little bit more fairly, perhaps this will knock down our rate of catheter-related bloodstream infection. So I'll close with that kind of farcical and whimsical approach towards the prevention of healthcare-associated infections, and I'll turn it back over to Martin. So again, thank you, all of you who have participated. And again, this will be archived on the site, and I hope there will be more people who look at it down the road.
Mark, thank you so much. That was another fantastic journey through the life of the central venous catheter. Like you, I share the frustration that so many studies say that we put a bundle into place and it seemed to work, but they don't tell you ever what the compliance with the bundle was, either at the beginning or at the end. Just that it seemed to work. And I'd really like to see some people report compliance, because it may well be that even when the bundle is fully implemented, that compliance still isn't anything like 100%, but even what percentage of compliance with the bundle does start to reduce infection. I do also wonder about technology and the use of it. And I think it was you I heard say a number of years ago, you put up a slide which quoted, I think it was Bob Weinstein, which said, if you can choose between behavioral change and a gizmo, go for the gizmo every time. And I'm often a little bit nervous about bringing in technology when you haven't really got all the behaviors that you want in your healthcare professionals. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, Martin, I think those are both insightful comments, and I agree with the first comment on the bundle and which aspects of the bundle are perhaps more important than others. What's the compliance with it? I think we still have a long ways to go and a lot to learn about that. I think that some of those practice measures are important, and I think that we're appreciating that the other aspect of catheter care that has been somewhat neglected is what you do after the insertion that also counts. And so making sure that you're scrubbing the hub and that you're doing the dressing changes and the things that, may make a difference are somewhat more difficult to police. It's easier to put in the insertion guidelines, but it's harder to do the things day in and day out. And then you're correct with that quote by Bob, choose the gizmo every time. And I think what he's trying to imply with that is that it is hard to change human behavior. And if you can introduce something that takes the human behavioral aspect out of the equation, that oftentimes that is an easy way to proceed. Unfortunately, in infection control and in various other areas, the fool is usually more powerful than the foolproof. And so you can take any of these technologies and you can overwhelm them. So you can, if you're not using good aseptic practices in the insertion and care for a catheter, I don't care what it's coated with or what kind of dressing you put on, you can still get those catheters infected. So I think the behavioral aspects, the educational aspects, will remain important no matter what kind of innovative technology is brought to bear on it.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think two of your slides nicely illustrated that, and I'm talking about the two with regard to the antiseptic caps, because the first one that didn't show a statistically significant reduction, even though it did show a reduction in rate, actually had a relatively higher rate if you compare their finishing rate, if you like, of 3.7 per 1,000 device days with the work done by Peter Pronovost and colleagues, where they implemented the bundle, whereas in the Wright study, where they had got a lower rate, they've still managed to show a statistically significant reduction, and that was also true of the Timsit studies with regard to the chlorhexidine dressing. So, to me, that feels like if you really get your human factors right and your behaviour right, and you're still not getting quite to zero, then technology can really move you forward down to that last little bit. But I also take your point about the law of diminishing returns, and you highlighted that paper from Nicholas Graves, who's now working out of Brisbane, where the health economics really need to be taken into account. I wonder if I could just ask you one last question, and that's about the chlorhexidine, because in some parts of the world, and we've had reports in France, there are strains of MRSA in particular that seem to be resistant to chlorhexidine. They have the Quok A gene. And would you think that would be a concern for blanket use of chlorhexidine in dressings? Would that worry you at all?
Yeah, Martin, again, another very insightful question, and I think that is something that we certainly need to keep our eye on, that these organisms are adaptable, that they do react to stresses that are put upon them, as we've seen over and over again, obviously, with antibiotic resistance. But you see the same thing to somewhat of a lesser extent with some of the antiseptics. There are strains that are described now, again, with the Quok or Quack gene complex, which is an efflux pump, that seems to cause some decrease in the susceptibility or an increased MIC, if you will, of some of the staphylococcal strains that possess that. Now, it's at a relatively low rate, so even in the Quack-positive strains, the susceptibility is still well within the range that you're usually going to achieve with application of chlorhexidine. But I agree with you. I think that, sort of these carpet bombing, blanket sort of measures sometimes don't make great sense and probably not over the long haul. So I think it is something that we need to keep in mind, that we need to survey for.
Thank you very much, Mark. Well, it just remains for me to thank you again for a tremendous lecture. It's always such a pleasure to hear you speak. And to say to the audience, we hope you've enjoyed this session, to highlight that there are a number of teleclasses coming up in the not-too-distant future in preventing catheter-associated urinary tract infections. So Liam Donaldson from the World Health Organization is going to be talking about global patient safety. There'll be a session on infection control during disasters and on the European Union Directive on Prevention of Sharps Injuries, which will be no stranger to colleagues in the United States. If I could close by thanking Mark again, by thanking Paul Weber for facilitating this fantastic series, and our thanks to Teleclass Education patron sponsors Virox Technologies and the World Health Organization. If anybody has any questions for Mark, please, if you would email me, my email address is on the front of today's presentation. I'll be very happy to forward them on to Mark, and I know he's very happy to answer any of your queries. Can I wish you all a very good day, and I hope you've enjoyed this session, and I look forward to speaking with you all again soon. Thank you very much indeed.